Log Talk Radio.
When a parent lashes out at the other parent in front of a child, or simply says hurtful things about the other parent in front of a child, they are also attacking that child's sense of self-worth and confidence. This is an act of alienation and is harmful to children and can cause a lifetime of issues for the child. Issues as serious as anxiety, depression, substance abuse, and thoughts of or actual suicide. Help spread the word. Visit www.paawareness.org.
Well, this is Jill Ajizi, and I want to welcome you all this evening to Family Matters. Thank you all for tuning in. It is an exciting night for us tonight. We're talking about the symposium that will be held in New York on October 2nd and 3rd, put on by Goldberg and Associates. So we'll touch on that in a minute, but I wanted to tell you we're missing a very important person tonight, and that is my wonderful friend and co-host, Judge Michelle Lawrence, who I am so proud to say is in the Netherlands presenting her divorce philosophies in front of The Hague, which is just wonderful. Our dear friend Faye Levin is the ambassador to the Netherlands and invited Michelle over to do just that, and she is so pleased and proud to be able to be involved in presenting this divorce philosophy that she is so put together so well in her book, The Good Karma Divorce. We love Judge Michelle for what she does, and if all judges were like Michelle, there would be so much less parental alienation in the world and so much more divorce that isn't so adversarial and hate and win-win and all of the things that we don't like about divorce settings in the United States and across the world. So, Michelle, good luck to you tonight if you're listening. And I wanted to also say, I mentioned last time on the show that I was elected president of Parental Alienation Awareness Organization, and I'm so proud to be at the helm of that organization, and we're working towards increasing awareness and educating people about parental alienation all around the world. And it is something that has to be done, and we will do it. We are going to make PAAO a household name, and we are going to try to eradicate parental alienation as we know it. Tonight, I've got some great, great guests and a lot of them, and I'm so excited to have many, many people. And I think that, Joe, are you on the line now?
I am on. How are you?
Great. I am so happy to have you here. I was getting worried about you.
Thanks very much. It's for having me on the show.
Well, I'm happy to have you here because you do such important work, and I just want to introduce some of the other people that we're going to have on tonight. Attorney Brian Ludmer, Dr. Richard Sauber will be calling in about 8:10, and Dr. Abraham Warnklein is here with us. Welcome, Abraham.
Good to be on the show.
And Dr. William Burnett is here from Vanderbilt University. Hello, William. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, Jill. Thank you.
And I believe maybe Dr. Glenn Ross Caddy is on now. Dr. Caddy, are you
actually
here?
Actually, I think, Jill, I think that Dr. Caddy said that he's going to be on about 8:15 because he was running
8:15.
Late for an appointment.
Okay.
Right.
Well,
and Jill, forgive me. I'm going to call back on a different line because the one that I'm on is getting a number of interruptions. So with me as I call you in on a different line.
Sounds good. We'll wait for you. While we are waiting for him to give a call back, Bill, I want to just have you, because there may be some people, hopefully there are some people who are listening that don't know what parental alienation is. Can you just give me the very simple terms for parental alienation?
Sure, Jill. Parental alienation is a very difficult situation that occurs in the context of a difficult divorce, specifically a highly conflictual or hostile divorce. And what basically happens in parental alienation is that the child gravitates to one side, to one parent, and rejects the other parent. So the child becomes very, very closely aligned with one parent and rejects or refuses to see or refuses to visit the second parent. and it can go either way. Sometimes the mother is on one side or the father. The child might gravitate to the mother, might gravitate to the father. And there are different reasons why it happens, but a common reason is that the child is gravitating to the parent as a result of brainwashing. In other words, it doesn't always happen this way, but it commonly happens that one parent is indoctrinating the child against the other parent. And, of course, that's a very destructive thing to do because it interrupts, prevents the child from having a good relationship with both the mom and the dad.
Absolutely. When you say, Bill, it doesn't always happen that way, what other ways can it happen?
Well, that's the most common thing, but there are other possibilities. Just as an example, it could be that somebody other than the parent is doing the indoctrinating. And occasionally therapists even get involved in these family cases and end up turning the child toward one parent and against the other. And another thing that might happen is that the two parents are just a huge fight. There's a huge battle going on. And it isn't so much that anybody's actively indoctrinating the child, but that in this big battle, the child runs for cover. The child doesn't want to be in the middle of the big battle because it just creates tremendous loyalty issues for the child. You know, whose side am I on? Do I favor mom or dad? And so as a way to avoid being in the middle of the battle, the child runs to one side and attaches himself to one parent and shuns the other parent. So that conceivably could happen without anybody actively indoctrinating the child.
Okay. Well, Abraham, I want to direct a question to you. How is this different than a situation in which a child has legitimate reasons for not wanting to have anything to do with a parent? And how can you tell?
Okay, I think that what we need to recognize is that when we take a look at an alienated child, it's not only that the child persistently refuses to spend time with one of the parents. The key there is that there aren't any justifiable, there are no normal, realistic reasons or developmentally appropriate reasons. In other words, the basis that the child gives for not wanting to go to that parent make absolutely no sense, particularly since this is a child who formerly had a very good relationship with that other parent. When we look at a child who is what we call estranged, this is a child who also resists contact with one parent. However, in that particular case, the child has normal reasons, realistic reasons. So, for example, if the child refuses to go to one of the parents in the event that there was a history of abusive behavior, or the parent may have shown a very authoritarian parenting style where the consequences for the child's behavior were very rigid, they were very severe, very punitive, you could understand that a child would not want to do that. I remember having a child who refused to go to one parent because that parent constantly badmouthed the other parent, and the child's repetitive times telling the parent, please do not speak to my mother, let's say, in that case, and the father did not, follow it. Basically, the kid just said, hey, I'm not going. We also need to know that when we take a look at the rejected parent in the case of an estranged parent, very often the personality of that parent may be very critical and rejecting, and the parent may lack empathy. But one area that we need to take into account is that sometimes it's not so much the rejected parent. In some cases, a child will gravitate toward one parent and completely reject the other parent, as Bill had said, for the reason that he had given. But also, very often, the parent who is the aligned parent is extremely, extremely permissive and communicates messages to the child that basically it's either him or me, or her or me, and the child often gravitates to a parent with whom he is more secure, as Bill correctly stated. So again, when we look at estranged parents, These are parents who basically there may be legitimate reasons why the child does not want to go. In the case of alienated parents, the reasons that the child gives for not wanting to go are totally unrealistic and basically, you know, make no sense, particularly in the context of the previous relationship that the child had with that parent.
Okay. Bill, do you think it's easier to treat parental alienation when it's in the early stages?
Oh, I certainly do think that. We typically kind of classify parental alienation as mild, moderate, or severe. Mm-hmm. And when it's mild, the child still has a pretty good relationship with the parent that's alienated. In other words, the child complains about going to see that parent, says, oh, I don't like that parent, I don't want to see that parent. But underneath, the child still has affection for that parent. And in fact, in a mild case, even though the child complains, the child does go and spend time with that second parent and has a good time. So obviously, that is a much milder situation than the more severe, in severe cases, the child doesn't just complain, but the child absolutely refuses or becomes terrified. The child might develop a fear of the alienated parent. And this is a fear that's not justified. In other words, this is essentially the child might have a false belief or almost delusion, you might say, that the alienated parent is an evil person or a dangerous person. And so when it gets up to being that serious or that severe, it's very, very hard to turn the situation around. It's much easier in a mild case when the child still underneath, even though the child complains, the child underneath still has affection for the second parent. So the ideal thing that would happen is for people to recognize this phenomenon or this process when it's still at the beginning, before it progresses to a more severe stage.
Brian, are you on?
Yes, I am, Jill.
Brian, I want to ask you, when you're dealing with a child who's in the early stages of parental alienation, and you've obviously recognized that and you're representing clients, how do you deal with that in a courtroom situation?
Okay, the idea is to not wait and to act at the earliest stages of the interference with access or refusal to visit. It may take a motion or two before the court starts to realize what's going on. And frankly, caught at the early stages, most courts are quite supportive that absent something major that would convince, say, a child protective service to put a freeze on, there's no reason why the child shouldn't be there, and whatever reasons are being put forward are insufficient. So the most important thing is track the data. Are the phone calls mm-hmm. happening? Are the visits happening? And you come prepared with a chart showing a pattern. It's not just a singular day where the child wasn't well or had some special activity. And most courts early on will be amenable to stopping this in its nascent stages before a broader dynamic takes place.
And that protocol, of course, is much different than when you're dealing with a child who is severely alienated and your efforts to rebrand that target parent. So then how do you handle that situation?
For a child who is absolutely and totally refusing to visit, in a sense it makes the lawyer's job easier because if there's no smoking gun in terms of verified abuse or anything like that, it's the very extreme nature of the child's disposition that pretty well informs any third party, be it a therapist or a court, that there's something else going on here, particularly where you can show through a historical buildup in your court materials that the onset was rapid, usually coincident with some blow-up or the financial negotiations heating up. And so you look in and around the time that the extreme nature of the child's disposition started to take effect, and there is just no observable reason for it, or the reasons being advanced are obviously insufficient to generate that kind of behavior, and that will inform. So how do you deal with it? Procedurally, it's the same legal procedures. You may have some bells and whistles to deal with in terms of these types of cases often present with false allegations of abuse and things of that sort, thus complicating the discourse. You may need at that point a custody and access assessment, a third party looking at the situation and sorting out the child's express reasons for not attending and are they valid or not, and then reporting back to the court. But the process is the same, and sometimes the child's extreme disposition makes it easier, sometimes harder, because courts sometimes are unfortunately timid in their response.
Okay, but a judge making a swift decision is key to not allowing that alienating parent to have time to perform their alienation and brainwashing tactics, don't you think?
Yes, clearly, and the thing is, in cases of abject refusal to visit, respond to emails, respond to phone calls, quite often, as the listeners have already heard, the buzzword I have for a child caught in the middle is defensive splitting. So the child has to split just because they're in a completely untenable situation where one parent is forcing them. It's you're either for me or against me. And I've had several cases where a strong intervention by the court saying, produce the child, all of a sudden a child who fell off the face of the earth for 9 months is back and is happy, and the relationship resumes because the child has been freed from the loyalty bind. So ultimately, at the end of the day, with parents who either foster a loyalty bind short of hatred, just that the child can't show the love, or who are propagating actual hatred, a strong court intervention will usually force their hand.
Great. I want to digress just a moment back to Joe Goldberg. Are you back, Joe Goldberg?
Yes, Jill. Hi.
Hi. You are the reason we are all here tonight, and I want to talk to you about what you do. You are a Goldberg and Associates, and I was reading about you and didn't realize that you were actually involved personally in a parental alienation case. And I don't know if you're willing to touch on that, but if you would, I'd love for you to. And tell me briefly what happened and why you're doing what you're doing.
I have quite a history of experience with parental alienation. First, as a child, I experienced it as my parents went through a divorce, and later as a targeted parent. And also, it's interesting that Dr. Amy Baker, in her research, helped to clarify that quite often children who are victims of parental alienation later become targeted parents. So it is an intergenerational problem. After my own personal experience as a targeted parent, I decided to start working as a consultant. And it's a very interesting and challenging opportunity to help targeted parents that are going through it. Need a lot of special help in finding doctors to do psychological assessments, those that have a specialized knowledge in this field. It is a very narrow subspecialty of psychology. There's a lot of reasons why, when somebody does a psychological assessment, they need to find a doctor that has a specialized knowledge, especially if there's allegations of parental alienation. And it's important along the way for people that are involved in these cases to perhaps have a consultant helping them in many phases of the case.
I think that's very important. And I find with a lot of the people who contact PAAO and just contact me on a daily basis that they don't know where to go. First, some of them don't understand what's happening to them, and they've just found this name of parental alienation, much like I did 6 years ago, just Googling things on the internet and finding that this was what was happening to me and that it was happening to other people, which gives you some sense of of relief, I guess, that you're not the only one out there. And turning to the right people to help you with your case, and I didn't get that help in time. So now I think with PAAO, when we can direct people to the correct mental health professionals and the correct legal people to help them with their cases, how important is that for them to find the right people, Joe?
Well, if you don't surround yourself with the right professionals to help in a case of parental alienation, I wouldn't bet the house on it, that's for sure. I have seen far too many people in situations where they've been very valiant in their efforts to fight on in trying to repair the ruptured relationship that they have, hoping that a court intervention will come along and recognize the problem that exists and do the right thing. Unfortunately, if you don't present the case effectively, if you don't have the right evidence to support it, if you don't have the right professionals giving guidance and opinions to the court, it isn't very likely that you're going to have a good outcome.
How important is it to people in rural areas or in parts of the country where they're just very isolated to get to people like you to help them find these people that can really help their case? I mean, I know that here in Springfield, Illinois, there is one woman who has any kind of experience at all with parental alienation, and it is very minimal. There is nobody that's equipped to deal with a severely alienated child. How do you find these people that are able to talk the talk and walk the walk?
That's a good question. You know, I have to say, not just in rural areas, even in very urban cities heavily populated, it can be very difficult to find the right professional, let's say, to step in and do a psychological assessment. It's not like you can find one of these experts in the field on every street corner. They're very far and few in between. And, very frequently what, you have to do is find a list of the very best doctors and a lawyer that offers to allow the other side to select one of the very best professionals on your list and, mm-hmm. Make the point about the allegation that parental alienation is allegedly occurring and that it's important to have one of those doctors with that expertise appointed by the court to either validate or invalidate if it's going on. You can't have somebody that doesn't have the right expertise trying to detect a problem if they can't identify it to begin with. So it's very important that you have a professional who can work with a lawyer, who could provide that information to the lawyer. And sometimes it doesn't matter that the doctor comes from a different city or halfway across the country, as long as you get the very best doctor to do the evaluation.
Well, speaking of doctors, we have plenty of them tonight, and you're all going to be at a symposium in New York on October 2nd and 3rd. And, Joe, that is sponsored by your group, CSPAS. Is that correct?
Yes.
Why don't you just touch on that? We'll talk about it again later, but just tell us a little bit about the symposium. And what we're doing tonight here is really a little mini symposium, and all of these people that are on tonight will be speaking at your conference in New York.
That's correct. This is a landmark conference on the topic of parental alienation, past, present, and future. The very best experts in the field are going to be speaking at this two-day event in New York City. It's a wonderful opportunity to help educate many family law lawyers, many mental health professionals, family mediators, professionals involved in child abuse investigation work. It's a terrific opportunity for parents who are targeted parents to attend as well.
And it's a two-day event. And what are the hours and what's the cost involved with the conference?
Well, the conference will begin with registration check-in at about 7:30 in the morning, and it goes on all day Saturday, October 2nd. Then we have an evening program with Dr. Amy Baker Saturday evening, and then it continues on Sunday until 5 p.m. And the cost is $195 for the two-day registration.
And I believe you've offered PAAO members a reduced rate, and I think that was $95. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Good. Good. So all of you PAAO members, all 4,000 of you, come out and please attend Joe's conference in New York, because I think you're going to glean some very valuable information. Bill, I want to go back to you for a second. Let's talk about why parental alienation should become an official psychiatric diagnosis.
You know, Joe sort of set the stage for that, because there really aren't enough mental health professionals who really understand this condition. We mm-hmm. all need to do a lot of work in educating the people who are already in practice, the attorneys in practice, the mental health professionals, but also all the trainees, you know, the social workers, the psychologists, the psychiatrists. And one way to do that is that the concept of parental alienation needs to be accepted, that it really happens. It devastates families. It destroys the child's relationship with one or and sometimes both parents. And everybody needs to appreciate that it really happens. So one way to approach this is to help for the proposal that parental alienation should be an official diagnosis. The psychiatrists and psychologists in this country use a book called the DSM, which stands for the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. And every so often, the DSM has a new edition, and that's actually being written right now. That there are several years going into the creation of the next edition of the DSM. So what I did, I got together a large committee, and together we've submitted a proposal to the DSM personnel that parental alienation should be officially recognized. And the main reason is it will help mental health professionals appreciate it, realize that it's a real thing. And then why does that matter? Well, that matters because what we hope is that children and families will be recognized at an earlier stage. In other words, if a social worker or a psychologist is seeing a family and this kind of problem pops up, the social worker, the psychologist, the psychiatrist will be able to say, hey, I know what this is. This sounds like parental alienation, and we need to address it. We need to do something about it at this early stage before it gets much, much worse. So that's our basic goal as to getting it in the book. When we talk about getting it in the book, meaning getting it in the DSM.
Mm-hmm. How positive do you feel about the outcome of that?
Oh, I think it's going to end up somewhere in the DSM. What's interesting is the DSM is a very big, complex document. You know, it's hundreds and hundreds of pages. And so one idea is that parental alienation would be an official mental disorder. However, some people think there's another category of mental conditions in the DSM, which is called relational problem. Those are also mental conditions, but they come under a separate heading or a separate category. And there already is a relational problem called parent-child relational problem. In other words, that kind of disturbance is already in the current edition of the DSM. So some people think that the idea or the phenomenon of parental alienation would fit really well under the heading of a relational problem. Other people think it should be a mental disorder. So I don't know. You know, when we wrote up this proposal, we wrote it in such a way that either end result would be okay. But I'm pretty sure it's going to end up in one of those categories. Or actually, there's still a whole other category, by the way, which is the DSM, in its wisdom, has a chapter for conditions that need further study. and so it might end up there. In other words, the people who are in charge of the DSM might say, well, there's not enough research yet, but we're going to put it in the book, and it's going to be listed, and the definition and the criteria are going to be there. but it needs further study. So that would be okay.
If it ends up in that category, then how are we situated as far as its use in a courtroom setting?
Oh, I think it would greatly enhance its ability to be used in the courtroom in any of these three possibilities in DSM. In other words, what happens in court is that sometimes people say, oh, you know, there's no such thing as parental alienation, that nobody officially recognizes it. But I think if it were in DSM in any of those three possibilities, that it would be possible to say in court that look, it is recognized, that the psychiatrists and psychologists agree that it really exists.
Bill, are there mental health professionals that are opposed to admitting it into the DSM?
Well, there are some. I think virtually every mental health professional agrees that mental health professional that works with children of divorced parents agrees that this happens. Virtually every single one. But some of them feel that there's not enough research about parental alienation to put it in the DSM. And I think there are some people who are concerned that it might be abused. And others, they feel that if this were an official diagnosis, then perhaps a parent who is truly an abusive parent would blame the child's refusal to visit on the other parent and say that it's not because I'm abusive, it's because the other parent has brainwashed the children against me. So there are some people who are concerned that if this were an official diagnosis, it would be misused. And so that's the kind of concern. But my own opinion, and I think the opinion of my committee, you know, I have a big committee. We have 70 people on it from all over the world. And we really feel that that's a relatively small risk. In other words, that the advantages of parental alienation being recognized and the diagnosis being made early are much, much more important than the small risk that it might be misused at times.
Okay. Abraham, it's been said by some groups that parental alienation is a ploy used by men who want to get sole custody of their children. What are your comments on this, and then also the abuse that Bill talked about?
Well, first of all, I would say very emphatically that I've had files in which the mother was the alienator. I've had files that the father was the alienator. I don't think it's restricted. I know it's not restricted to one or to the other. Some individuals may feel that, you know, it's directed at women. Now that men are more able to get custody when we're looking at the best interests of the child as opposed to the tender years doctrine in terms of custody determination. However, as I said, I've been involved. I just was involved recently where basically it was the father that was the alienator. I had files recently that it was the mother. So I don't think that it's restricted to one or to the other. It may take place more with one. And I think that, you know, certain groups, as soon as they hear the word alienation, basically they go bananas with that because they feel that it's a way to get, you know, children away from the mothers. If a proper alienation evaluation is done, they will look at characteristics, they will look at the personality, they will take a look at the behavior of each of the parents and determine whether it is justified alienation, justified estrangement, or whether it's unjustified alienation. So I totally disagree with that statement. I know the many groups that rally around the flagpole with this whole idea that it's, you know, a ploy for men to get custody away from the women. I don't buy that for one minute.
Okay. Brian, when you're working with people, and you are not licensed in the U.S., is that correct?
That's correct.
So when you're working in Canada, are you finding that the percentages are larger for men to women, or how do you see it in Canada?
I would say the same thing that Abe said, that this is not a gender-based dynamic. And in terms of my practice, I would say it's 50-50. But the point that I usually like to make to people is that women suffer in every single case, because even if the dad is the targeted parent, there's a grandmother who invariably is wiped out of the child's life as well, aunts, female cousins, female friends of the family. So this shouldn't be sidetracked into a gender-based discourse. Women suffer on every single one of these cases, and we should move on to dealing with the real meat and potatoes, which is what all the speakers are addressing here tonight, and there is no gender-based issue.
That's really important to point out. I think that so many people had been lumbering under the impression that men were primarily affected by parental alienation, and I just recall when my book came out the first week, I had 463 emails from non-custodial moms who were speaking out finally because they had that stigma of being a mom without her kids attached to them, and they were just embarrassed and very hesitant to be vocal. But some of them have really come into their own and are being great advocates for themselves now, for their children, and for the organization PAAO. So I'm very proud of them. But it is definitely not a gender issue.
If I could also add, I had a meeting with approximately 50 to 55 women from the tri-state area, New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut, about a half a year ago in New York. And they were all women. They all were experiencing alienation to a greater or to a lesser extent. So it's, you know, I think that we have to really take into account what Brian said, is that one of the characteristics of alienation, at least when you get to the moderate or the severe form, is that the child is not only being alienated, whether it's from the father or from the mother, but rather there's generally a generalization to other members of that target parent's family, because they blame the parents of let's say that parent for creating an individual who, you know, is seen in a totally, totally negative way. And I think that it's a myth that it's only, you know, it's gender related. I think that it's something that really, that myth really has to be broken. And my experience, as it is, you know, I think all of the speakers, is that, you know, if we do a proper evaluation, it does not come down to gender.
Great comment. Let's talk about what treatments there are for parental alienation. First, before we do that, let's talk about how we can prevent parental alienation from happening in the first place. And I'd like for all of you to comment, because I think there's varied thought processes on this and how to avoid it altogether. So why don't each of you comment? Abraham, would you like to go first?
Well, yeah, I'm going to comment on that. I'd also like to add another dynamic into the picture, which empowers children to alienate, you know, to be alienated or to alienate one of the parents. There's a concept, at least in Canada there is, of the child's attorney, and based on a recent Supreme Court judgment, a child can have an attorney not to state to the court what the attorney believes is best for the child, as it had been in the past, but rather to act like an attorney for an adult, in that even though the client is a child, the client basically has the right to have his views presented to the court. So the attorney will often just basically, this is what my client's wishes are, and this is what I am here to fight for. So again, when you have, you know, whether it's a 13-year-old, a 14-year-old, in some cases a 12-year-old, who goes and gets an attorney appointed for them, it reinforces a lot of the alienating effects on that particular child, particularly since now there's a professional who basically is advocating for this particular child. A couple of months ago, I think, I spoke about parental alienation and this whole concept of the child's attorney, although, you know, the intentions are excellent. I think that what we're seeing increasingly is that judges will often, I think there was, and Brian could, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, there was a judgment in Toronto where the child's attorney said, this is my client's, you know, wishes, and this is my client's wishes, and my client is of age, you know, and his wishes have to be heard to, have to be listened to, rather. And the judge said, well, yes, I do believe that, except that it's not, I do not believe that it's your client's wishes. I believe it's the alienating parent's wishes. And consequently, I will not go along with the child. So I think that, you know, that's a very large factor. I think that, you know, I believe Bill had alluded to it earlier. I think that there are many professionals who basically get involved and who create a situation where the alienation is reinforced rather than telling a parent who is doing the alienation, pointing out why it's detrimental, why it is probably one of the most severe forms of emotional abuse, but that parent who is basically energized, reinforced, and basically validated, as the child is sometimes, it creates tremendously more difficulty in terms of correcting the situation, of intervening in the situation, of getting the appropriate therapy by qualified professionals who have experience in terms of reuniting the family.
Bill, do you want to comment?
Yeah, I think we're talking about how to treat it, how to prevent it, and the prevention can be addressed on a number of different levels. Abe was just talking about from the point of view of the attorneys as to which side or what the attitude of the attorneys is. But starting even with children, one of our colleagues, Dr. Amy Baker, has developed this prevention program to use with children in the school setting. And you have meetings with children whose moms and dads are getting divorced or who recently got divorced. And it's a beautiful program, and it basically it rests on the premise children should not be put in the position of having to choose, that children don't have to choose between their mom and their dad, and that when their mom and dad split up, that everybody really, really wants them to have a nice, good relationship with both their mom and their dad. So that's an example of a prevention program on the level of the children. You know, on the level of the grown-ups, I think we really have to try to achieve a value system in which even though people get divorced, we really believe, honest to goodness, that it's good and it's for children to have a relationship with both parents, even if the parents are angry at each other or resentful or whatever. And we really have to push that. You know, I know that the attorneys I meet here in my community, which is in Tennessee, some attorneys really believe that. I mean, there are many attorneys who are nice people, that they really feel that the next 6 weeks should not be tearing each other apart, but that the next 6 weeks should be spent in helping the parents achieve some sort of distance from each other, let them get divorced, but do it in a way where the children are not victimized by the process. There really are attorneys who believe that, and it's wonderful to see them in action. And they turn down cases. You know, if a parent comes to them and says, I want to destroy my ex-partner, the attorney says, well, I'm sorry, you're going to have to see somebody else. But then I realize that not everybody goes that way. I mean, I think there are attorneys who really encourage the fighting and encourage the hostility and encourage the going back to court over and over again. So I think there are lots of places where intervention can occur between the child, the parents, attorneys, the whole, and of course, there's concern that the whole legal system, at least in some countries, and I guess the United States is a good example, that the whole legal system is so adversarial that it encourages people making accusations and people fighting and people disputing each other rather than trying to work it out. So there are many possible areas of trying to prevent this from happening. You know, we think that this affects about 1% of children and adolescents. We don't know for sure. There's really no way to know exactly what percent. But that's hundreds of thousands of kids, 1%. Yeah. And we really wish that there weren't so many of them.
There are also,
Brian?
Jill, there are also some jurisdictions in the States where if an individual, if a couple is thinking of separating, divorcing, they are required, I think Dade County is one of them, they
yes,
are required
you're right.
to attend parenting classes, post-divorce parenting classes or groups, and the children as well are required to be in groups for children. They are not going to be heard in court unless there is proof that they have attended it. I think the Sandcastles program, you know.
Right. Gary Newman has a great program, Sandcastles
program.
Program.
One
of
the better ones that I've seen.
Love it. He's a great guy.
Preventing it.
Well, I think you guys are right on target. Brian, do you have any great ideas?
Well, being a lawyer, I was certainly listening to the previous conversation with great interest. Let me talk about the role of the children's lawyer. It's an immensely harmful dynamic. You take children in the midst of this and you give them a lawyer. Why do they need a lawyer? They need a venue in which to be heard, and even the jurisprudence supports the fact that a custody and access assessment is a better way to get the wishes before the court. In Canada, certainly, judicial interviews of children are highly frowned on and rarely done. So there does need to be some sort of mechanism to get the children's voice before the court, but that could just as easily be some therapist, social worker who interviews the child, who has the right kind of skills. Lawyers aren't trained for this, number one. Number two, lawyers are advocates when you really need somebody to translate the children's distress and mixed feelings for the court. And very few children's lawyers are adept at sifting through what they're seeing in these cases. Thankfully, however, there is a developing body of jurisprudence that says that the role of a child's lawyer in a case potentially of alienation is to surface to the court the fact that the child's views are disproportionate to the issues and that the child may be manipulated, so that the court is appropriately guarded in terms of the weight it is going to accord to the children's views.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty clear in papers written by lawyers directly associated with the Office of the Children's Lawyer here in Ontario. In terms of the role of lawyers for the parent, I agree that there's a cadre in the family law bar that should really pay more heed to the need to protect children in these cases, and that there's a lot of cases where clients are not being given the guidance that they really should have. I do bring a different perspective because I maintain a mixed practice. I do business and securities law for the other half of my brain, and it's a much safer and saner world than the family law system that we have. So I echo the comments of Bill and Abe in that we are dealing with a terrible social dynamic in the midst of a dysfunctional system.
Well, Brian, how do you feel about the education of family law judges and keeping them up on what's going on, especially with parental alienation? Because I know in the county where I reside, none of the judges have dealt with parental alienation in the way that it should have been handled. So how do you think we can continue to educate our judges?
Well, that's a great question, Jill, because what we have seen with the judicial institutes that are run, certainly in Ontario where I practice, is that you get a spike in cases where judges are getting it in the 6 months after someone of the caliber of the speakers at this conference has participated in a judicial institute and spoken about the dynamic and how to recognize it, and most importantly, how harmful it is to children and how over-empowered children in these cases are. So coming back to the lawyer point, you have children saying, "Don't talk to me, Mom. Talk to my lawyer." I mean, it's just immensely harmful. And the judges will get it when they get the benefit of this additional education. These are very problematic cases that require a different procedure and a different treatment. Professor Bala at Queen's University in Kingston, Ontario, has made a very valid point. These cases need to be recognized early on by the judges. taken out of the mainstream, case managed, and actively managed. You get the family back in front of you every month and say, well, why didn't that happen that you promised last time you were before me? And with that intense scrutiny and pressure, you can break this cycle and free the child.
Good, good. And do you think, you know, Judge Michelle and I talk very often about how she handles her courtroom much differently than I've seen any family court judge at all in Illinois, and I've seen a lot of them handle divorcing families and children as they go through her courtroom and come in front of her bench. I watched her one day as she sat for almost 6 hours with one family and dealt with the parental alienation aspect of this family, and it was just incredible how compassionate and wonderful she was with this family, and I really believe they were all going to walk out hand in hand and go home. You know, it was just such a wonderful outcome, and if everybody was like Michelle, I think that we could get this on the right track. And she and I have been speaking to groups all over the place, clergy and schools and judges and continuing legal education, trying to get the word out and make people understand. And a lot of times we're met with just stares and wide eyes and why are you trying to change this? This is our living, and this is what we do, and we don't want to be different. She was telling me that she was at the American Bar Association meeting out in San Francisco and speaking to them, and she got up and gave the speech, and it just wasn't accepted as well as it probably should have been. Dealing with
yeah.
someone's livelihood, I think that it's, you know, pretty sensitive.
Yeah, I think that the judges who get it are actually able to make a significant difference, and that sometimes it doesn't take the 6 hours. It takes a judge looking at the family and demanding a change in behavior and telling them, you're back before me in 3 weeks, and then I want to hear about three successful parent-child visits that take place in that period of time. Get me? And I have never seen a case where a judge does that it doesn't grease the wheels. As a matter of fact, without that, you get these cases in these endless cycles, and you keep coming back, and quite often, you know, before a different judge every time, and it just goes on and on and on with everybody passing the buck to the next appearance. And the next appearance, and meanwhile, all the dynamic is getting more and more entrenched. The other disconcerting thing is there is a substantial body of case law now that makes it very clear, and the discourse is important. The job of a parent is to parent. So you hear even judges say, well, I expect parent X to encourage the child to see the other parent. And they mean well by the comment, but they don't even understand the law. The law quite clearly is that it's the duty of the custodial parent in the particular circumstances to require the child. And you get the judges who really understand this area saying, this is as important as going to school, taking your immunization shots, and dealing with a traumatic illness where I don't care that you don't want to go to the emergency, we're going. So somehow a different standard applies to supporting the relationship between the child and the other parent. And to me, it's particularly disconcerting when I hear judges use the word encourage, because you're just playing into the hands of the aligned parent. They nod, of course I encourage. I've been telling you that I encourage. It's meaningless. Here's the better way to put it. You look at the aligned parent and you say, you're either lying to me or you're completely ineffective in supporting the relationship between the child and the other parent because you're not giving appropriate guidance and boundaries, incentives, and consequences. Either way, you're not an appropriate trustee for that child's right to a relationship with the other parent. So in other words, deliver or lose the child. And every single aligned parent will step up and do the right thing rather than risk a reversal of custody. So most of these cases can be solved by absolute intransigence on the part of the judiciary demanding a solution, and parents will come around.
Joe, what are your ideas on trying to keep this from happening?
Well, I first I want to say, there's been so many really great comments, made by the speakers. I think, it's very sad. You related an experience that's, all too common to targeted parents, which you said was going online and Googling, what is this thing that I'm dealing with, and then discovering parental alienation. And I find that to be like, if this was, a game show, what would be the number one way that targeted parents find out about it? Online. That's how they find out about it. And it's a tragedy in a way because, I think that there are things that can be done in a preventative way to educate parents quickly because, and I think, parenting classes should be mandatory. Any parent that's going through a divorce with children, it should be a state law that says you've got to go to a parenting class, and part of the criteria of that class has to include some very important information about parental alienation, helping them understand, if you see this happening in your situation with your children, this is what it is. And this is something you need to bring to the attention, of your lawyer. And I think lawyers, are almost, I hate to say it, but, almost borderline, malpracticing when they don't know about this problem. Because I talk to so many family law lawyers. They don't know what to do with a case like this. They don't know how to help people with these problems. They wouldn't know where to begin. A lot of them don't want to even go and take these kind of cases. They go into collaborative law just to get away from some of this. And I think that, lawyers, if you're going to be practicing family law, you need to know what to do. And you need to be able to educate your client the minute they walk through the door, so that before it begins to be a problem that takes root in a child, that parent starts to see some of these signs, some of these warning signs, and alerts their lawyer about it. So we could try to catch it in the mildest stage before it becomes a more moderate or severe problem.
Well, all of those options should be helpful to the people that are listening tonight and that will listen in the coming weeks. And I thank you for all those great ideas. I know that Bill has to leave in about 3 minutes. So, Bill, I wanted to ask you, can you tell me or tell our listeners how we can get involved in the process of helping you get your project through to completion with the DSM issue? Is there a letter writing campaign? Is there a petition that we can sign?
Well, I think that's great of you to ask me that. I mean, we need all the help we can get. I know that lots and lots of people, lots of mental health professionals, legal professionals, and everyday people have expressed an interest in this and have written letters. There are specific people at the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual Task Force. It's called the DSM-5 Task Force that are in charge of this, and it would be great for people to write to them. I'll tell you the best way to learn that is we've written this all up. In other words, we've published a couple of papers in good journals, and now we have a book coming out. And the book actually tells what people can do.
Great.
It actually it talks about all the reasons. The book talks about the 20 reasons why parental alienation should be a diagnosis. There's lots and lots. There are hundreds of references, including your book, by the way, just in case you're interested.
Yay.
Is in all these references. And one of the latter chapters, it says, this is what you can do. And we actually give the names and addresses of not only the people in the American Psychiatric Association, but also the people in the World Health Organization, because we're also trying to get this in the book put out by the World Health Organization called the ICD, and there's a man in Geneva who's in charge of that. So the book is easy to recognize. In other words, the name of the book is Parental Alienation. It has the word parental alienation in it and DSM-5. So it's easy to find on Amazon, or if you Google it, if you just put parental alienation DSM-5, you come up with this book. And
Okay. People
might be interested in it. It has the names and addresses, and they're welcome to contact me if they have ideas or want other suggestions.
Would you like to give out your contact information?
Oh, my email is real easy. It's my name, William.Burnett, B-E-R-N-E-T, at Vanderbilt, which is the name of the university, Vanderbilt, Vanderbilt.edu. So it's an easy email, and I'd be happy to try to answer people's questions if they want to get in touch.
Great. Hey, do you know the cost of the book?
Paperback is about $40.
Okay, good. I appreciate you so much in here.
This is a great show. I really enjoyed participating in this, Jill, and it's
nice
of you. And I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to run, but it's been great being here.
Well, we will carry on without you, although we'll miss you, and I hope to talk to you soon, Bill, and you have a great night, and thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
All right. Bye-bye. Okay, well, we will keep going. Guys, we have a caller that I'm going to take now, so let's see. I don't know what this no, we don't. Yes, we do. Here we go. Here it is. I don't know what this question is going to be. Hello, caller, 814 area code. How are you? Caller, are you there? Caller. Nope, she must have hung up. Okay, well, let's just keep going. Joe, I want to touch on some clips that you brought with you tonight. And can you kind of set those up for me?
Sure. you know, a lot of people who were involved in cases involving parental alienation are dealing with false allegations where they have to defend themselves. And a lot of people who are mental health professionals, you know, if you ask them, you know, what's the difference between a real case of abuse and, you know, when you're really dealing with a case involving parental alienation, how do you know? And at last year's conference, one of our speakers, who I believe your audience knows, and I think most people know of, Dr. Amy Baker, she very competently answered that question. So I'd like to play that video clip, if that's okay.
Sure, go for it.
Okay, here we go.
Let's listen.
One way to think about this is, well, how do we know if a kid who's exhibiting rejection of a parent isn't just rejecting that parent because that parent's abusive, right? We need to know this from a clinical point of view. Judges need to know. They don't want to send a kid to an abusive parent, right? They see a kid who says, I hate that parent and I never want to see that parent again. Well, how do we know that we should protect the child from that parent, or we should work towards a reconciliation? Well, the truth is, I think people make this more complicated than it needs to be, because kids who have been abused by a parent do not exhibit those 8 behavioral manifestations. They do not reject the abusive parent. Kids who have been burned, beaten, molested, the worst things a parent can do to a child, those kids want one thing. They want to go back to that parent. It was mommy's fault. No, they say, it wasn't mommy's fault. I was bad. That's why mommy hit me. Right? That's the classic abuse scenario of a child who's been abused. They don't say, I never want to see that abusive parent again. That's just not how abused kids behave. They blame themselves. And they do not proudly and widely discuss the abuse. Think back to that kid who wrote the letter to the mom's opponent running for the school board. Kids who have been abused do not do that. It's like a breakthrough, a miracle when you're doing therapy with an abused kid, when you finally can get them to admit the details of the abuse. Right? They don't, you know, take out newspaper ads and, you know, announce to everybody, you know, my parent's a horrible parent, all right? Mm-hmm. And they don't lack ambivalence. But kids who've been abused will say, well, mommy loses her temper sometimes, or daddy loses his temper and daddy might drink, but he's really good at this and he's really good at that and he really tries hard. They don't have that absolute black and white. Even if they see the abuse and even if they're willing to admit it, they don't wipe out everything good about that parent.
Yeah.
And they don't worship the other parent. And they don't reject the extended family of the abusive parent. The primary foster care mode at this point, at least in the United States, is known as kinship care, where kids who have been abused are placed with the relatives of the abuser. Right? That's like 40% at this point of kids in foster care are placed with kinship care. And those kids aren't resisting, you know, and ignoring and wiping out that entire family. Right? So it's two totally different clinical pictures between a child who's really been abused and a child who's been manipulated to reject one parent by the other parent.
Yeah.
So that was that clip from Dr. Amy Baker at the conference last year.
Mm-hmm. That is so interesting because I hear that so many times. Abe, do you hear that often from people? Why doesn't my child want me? Even abused kids want to go back to their parents. How do you respond to that?
Absolutely. I mean, if the child is, we know when we do an evaluation of an abused child and we know that the child was abused, the child, whether the child disclosed or whether we've proven it, they still want to maintain a relationship with the other parent. And alienated, in severe alienation, they want to have nothing to do with that parent, not only with that parent, they don't want to have anything to do with the extended family, they don't want to hear the name of the parent, they don't want to be in any situation, they don't want that parent to come to the school meeting, they don't want to come them to come to the hockey game or to the basketball game. It's so different than a child who has been abused. Yes, there are some children, for example, that want to have nothing to do, but that's not generally the case.
Abe, this is going to sound probably like such a stupid question, but how does this happen to a child? How can someone twist someone's mind that way and make them have so much hatred toward one person? How does that happen?
Well, I think Bill, first of all, alluded to that, you know, as one of the factors. That one of the factors were that the child may be insecure with the parent who is the alienator, who is the aligned parent, and consequently, and I've had this with a kid once that told me, you know, after the interventions and after the therapy and after the child was realigned with the target parent, they said, you know what, I was afraid. I knew in that particular case, I knew that my mother was always going to be there for me. My father, I wasn't sure. I was afraid. And he said that he wanted, that he was thinking of getting married and having new kids. And I was afraid that basically if I didn't go along with what he said, he would leave me. And, you know, so when we take a look at risk factors, which is, I guess, what you're asking for, you know, if a child is caught, as we said earlier, in the middle of intense parental conflict, you know, the school-age child is asked to take sides. The child may be threatened that if you're not with me, you're against me, and I don't want to have anything to do with you. We also need to know that if we look at parental alienation, we know that there are probably, based on the work of Klawar and Rivlin, there are probably 20 or so themes that parents will use. And often the child will be given inappropriate, unnecessary information. So, for example, I remember a good few years ago, a parent we're not just talking about leaving some of the documents on, you know, the dining room table where the kid could see it. But I remember one case which was really quite severe where one of the parents hired a detective to follow their ex. And basically what happened is that they took pictures of the ex, picking up different, it was different women. And basically what happened was that when the kid saw that, he got so turned off, he didn't want to have anything to do. Or disclosing information. I remember a case, which is so clear, one of the first cases I ever dealt with, parental alienation, where the child was told by his father that your mother gives every guy on the block a particular type of job, a blowjob. And, you know, the kid, when I met with the kid, I said, well, you know, I don't know what that means. What does that mean? And he said, I don't know, but that must be really bad. So presenting a parent with in a negative light, giving inappropriate, unnecessary information. In fact, part of my evaluation, one of the questions that I do ask, is I ask the parent, do you believe in always telling the child the whole truth? And sometimes, you know, you find out, you know, the parent will say, well, look, it depends on, you know, how old my child is going to be. It depends on the information. It may not be appropriate. Or you have some parents. Everything. The child is entitled to know it. The child is able to know everything. The child should know what his father is like or what his mother is like. Very often we have a parent who basically parentifies the child, who basically makes the child, I have this pretty often, who basically makes the child feel responsible to take care of that parent, or the parent presents him or herself as a martyr, you know, that they basically went through so much, and take a look at how your mom or your dad treated me. So again, you know, character assault, and basically presenting one parent as being, I mean, it does happen, it sometimes happens very subtly, the nonverbal message is not allowing the child, don't mention his name or don't mention her name in this house. I remember a case years ago where the parents, and it was on tape actually, because I think it was the father had all his telephones taped, you know, tape recorded, and basically right. The mother was telling the child, go through the drawers, look for any document that has the name bank on it, that says bank on it. You know, putting the child in such a conflict of loyalty, what parents need to remember is that a child comes from both mother and father. If the child feels that the mother is all bad or the father is all bad, it has to impact on the child's identity. It has to impact on guilt feelings that the child may have later. I remember years ago in a cult case that I had where there was alienation, where the parent told the child, your father is the son of Satan. And afterwards, I asked the child, well, how did that make you feel? So the kid told me, terrible, because if my father's the son of Satan, that means I'm the grandson. So again, you know, the parents, you know, sometimes don't believe in the concept of unconditional, the alienating parents, of unconditional love. The love is conditional. I will give you all my love if you take my point of view. That is said verbally, clearly, or it's said indirectly where the child has that message. And again, giving the child, you know, inappropriate statements, inappropriate messages, you know, having the child keep secrets. But again, the conflict of loyalty, putting the kid in the middle, has disastrous results on the kids. Coaching, again, I had that recently in a file, where basically, the telephone conversation was taped, where the child was told what to take from the father's home, was told what to take and what to do and what to say, everything very, very clearly. So again, you know, what we need to take into account is that when, you know, there's an alliance with the alienating parent, with the aligned parent, it has disastrous results on kids. As Joe said earlier, I mean, we know that it's not just as a child that it often creates anxiety and behavioral problems and anger, but it can affect the child's future relationships, and we know that from Amy Baker's research as well. We also need to take into account that often, and I think I alluded to it earlier, that, you know, a child may feel threatened by the parent, even, you know, the parent may say it, or it may be alluded to. So, and again, when you have a child, a parent is supposed to be a parent. You know, years ago, we as children wanted our parents' approval. Today, many parents will do anything to get the child's approval, and that often takes place in the case of an alienating parent. So, again, it does take place. Again, it does, and I should emphasize this, it definitely, one of the factors, one of the risks, in terms of why one child in a family is alienated and not the other child, one of the main things that we have to figure out is that it also depends largely on the child's age, because between the ages of, let's say, 8 and 11 or 8 and 12, What we know is that a child cannot maintain two opposing points of view. If a child is presented with one image of a parent as being, you know, all bad, and meanwhile the child has an image, well, hey, you know, he or she is, you know, really nice to me, it's very, very difficult for them to keep them both at the same time. And consequently, what happens is that they may become alienated because it's just too complicated for them. And again, you know, you have the cognitive factors, you have personality factors in the child. Some kids are more resistant to attempt by a parent to alienate the other parent. So again, you know, very often we find that the child not only is caught in the middle, but very often we find the parent, him or herself, had issues of abandonment as a child.
As
so
a
when
child, right.
When the divorce or comes around, the child, I'm sorry, the parent may get those same feelings of abandonment again, and consequently will work not to feel abandoned by the child. And in this case,
thank you, Abe. What an outstanding answer, and certainly helpful to all those that are listening. And I know while you were speaking, Dr. Richard Sauber joined us. Welcome back, Richard.
Thank you.
I'm so glad you could join us for these last few minutes. And I wanted to ask you along those same lines of what A was talking about. How do you change an alienating parent who has no conscience, constantly lies and charms everyone as he or she portrays you, the target parent, as the monster?
That's a good question. Often you're describing a sociopath that has no conscience, as you says, and does solely what they want to do. The first mistake the other parent usually makes is trying to please that parent and feed into their sense of power, actually gives them a sense of empowerment. So the first thing to realize is that you cannot change or negotiate with this kind of a parent. Now, often alienated parents, I mean, the alienator, that is the parent that constructs and implements the campaign of alienation, does have this personality trait of a sociopath, so that it's best not to try to work out compromise or other factors with the type person, because they insist it has to be their own way. So how do you deal with that kind of a person? The best way is documentation, and that is to record all the examples of incidents in which this person violates the shared parental responsibility doctrine. That is, that they will not co-parent, that they cancel visitations, they obstruct and interfere with any kind of communication, and as well try to tell the child that it's not really necessary to see that parent or visit with them. But the key is, one, not to negotiate, and two, to document, so that you do have numerous examples, well written, with dates, times, and explanations. So when it comes to a court hearing or some other format to change some of these rules, the judge is able to implement a plan that will work. So that's the answer to dealing with an alienating parent who portrays the other parent as either a monster or is a bad parent or is the hated parent.
And then what I want to know from you is, there's, in my case, I dealt with children who were adolescents going into their teenage years, and obviously that's much different than how you would deal with a 3 or a 4-year-old. So let's talk about, what do you do with a 16 or 17-year-old alienated child, knowing that your clock is rapidly ticking and the targeted parent has limited time to reconnect with that child before their 18th birthday when they become an adult?
Now, you mentioned the two most difficult ages are late adolescence, 16 or 17, because at age 18, the court no longer has jurisdiction, and 3 and 4-year-olds, because they're young, they don't really understand what's going on, and you have limited ability to interact and explain certain things to them other than in a play therapy format. Let's look at the 16 or 17-year-old. If they are the oldest child of younger siblings, they're often the leader of the pack, so that they're working on their younger sibling to alienate them, which that parent has already done their alienation with the teenager. If they're an only child, they tend to identify with the alienator in terms of the power, so it's very difficult to get them to change. And parents always say, well, let's bring them to therapy to try to point out to them how the rejected parent really has done no evil, nothing wrong, but rather has been a victim of alienation. But most therapists are not skilled in PAS kinds of therapy, so that the answer to how do you deal with that kind of situation is called reunification therapy, and that what you do is file a motion with the court indicating that you'd like a, let's say, mother and child or father and child, whoever the rejected parent is, with that child to enter into therapy in which the preferred or other parent does not participate. In this way, the alienated parent often has a choice of the therapist, whereas if it's a family situation or a therapy for the child himself, they have to get mutual consent. And therefore, the therapist is obligated to take into consideration both parents, which are in opposition to one another. In unification therapy, it's focusing on the rejected parent and the alienated child and how to bring them together without the other parent's interference. So one, in the choice of therapy, and two, that the focus is on reunification, and the child understands that is the purpose of trying to work out a better understanding between the parents, as opposed to individual or family therapy, in which the child merely says, I don't want to have anything to do with that parent. I don't want to visit them. I don't like them. I don't want to have any kind of contact. And the therapist is in a position that they can't sell the advantage of working out a relationship with that parent because it offsets the trust and confidence of the child in the therapy. But reunification clearly defines the objectives. Now,
well,
if
Richard, I want to just stop you for a second, and I want Brian to weigh in quickly because our show is going so fast, so I need another half an hour with you guys. But Brian, I want you to comment on what Richard is saying. Asking for reunification is such a wonderful concept, but when you actually put it into practice, how often, when you broach that subject with a judge, does he order reunification, he or she?
Who are you asking to comment, Brian or myself?
Brian, yeah. I want Brian to comment from a legal aspect. Brian, are you there? Brian is gone. Okay, well, Richard, why don't you, I mean, from your experience, how often do you think that reunification is ordered when it's asked for by an attorney for an alienated parent?
Well, generally what's happened when an attorney representing the rejected parent says, I haven't had contact with my son or daughter for a certain period of time, they refuse to visit with me, and use the term reunify, that gives the judge an out because they don't really know what to suggest to that parent. So often they will authorize that, and the parent's attorney has to say, I want to pick the therapist since I'm the one that has to feel comfortable with the reunification. And in that way, it excludes the alienating the preferred parent that would interfere with the process of reunification. So those are the keys that make it a successful process.
And how many people in the U.S., Richard, would you say are capable of dealing with reunification for parents, alienated parents and children?
I guess what you're asking is how many therapists are really trained in reunification?
Right. That's what I was trying to say. Not very well, apparently.
Well,
tell me what you think. How many do you think are available? Not too many, I'll bet.
Most therapists don't even know the term. So that's a problem. But it's easier for an uninformed, untrained therapist to do reunification because they deal with strange relationships between parent and child all the time, as opposed to dealing with family therapy or individual therapy with an alienated child. That leads to damage and further brings the child further apart from the alienated parent, because they often take the favor, they take the position in an alliance with the alienating parent, that is the preferred parent, against the rejected parent, if you follow what I'm saying.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we have 4 minutes left. The show has flown by. So, Joe, I want to give you the opportunity to tell us again about the conference in New York and how people can get the information to attend the conference, maybe give us a complete list of speakers. Just give me all the details on the conference.
Well, first of all, again, Jill, thank you so much for giving all of us tonight an opportunity to be on this program. And I would ask that everyone that is interested in coming to this conference go to our website and register online. Our website, of course, is cspas.ca, and all of the information about the speakers who will be at the conference, the titles of their presentations, synopsis of the presentation, the schedule. Of course, we're going to have Dr. William Burnett, Dr. Amy Baker, Dr. Terrence Campbell, Dr. Richard Sauber, Dr. Abraham Warren Klein, Demosthenes Lorandos, Dr. Glenn Caddy, Brian Ludmer, Pamela Richardson. I don't know if Dr. Caddy is with us at this last few minutes. Is he there?
I don't think he made it.
He didn't make it. Okay. So that is the benefit of the conference coming up in New York for mental health professionals, for family law lawyers, family mediators, and, of course, parents that are targeted parents. Everyone is welcome.
Everybody should go out and hear these great guys. This has been an outstanding show, and I am just so pleased that you all took the time here tonight to be with me on Family Matters. Of course, I would be remiss if I did not mention my co-host, Michelle Lawrence, Judge Michelle Lawrence's book, again, The Good Karma Divorce, an excellent tool for divorcing couples and really anyone who's having a conflict. And, of course, my book, The Look of Love, which is a novel about divorce and parental alienation, which I think is a really good read, and I need to get it into the hands of people who don't understand parental alienation and the horrors of divorce court so that they will get it and we can get the word out. Parental Alienation Awareness Organization is always available. We're online at paawareness.org. Please find us if you need help, and all of these guys are available on the internet. The internet is such a great tool. You can't hide. We're all out there. So find us. If you feel like you're alone, you're not. Certainly Joe and I have gone through this, and these other wonderful men tonight are so skilled in their tools and what they're talking about and how to help. So please take the time to find out, be your own advocate. Do what you need to do for yourselves and your children. Thanks, guys. Everybody have a great night. Thanks so much.
Take care. Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Joe.
Bye-bye. And what my heart has heard, well, it takes my breath away. I can hardly wait to hold you, feel my arms around you. How
It's on your face, the look, the time can't erase. Be mine tonight. Let this be just a start of so many nights like this. Let's take our lover's vow and then seal it with a kiss.
Thank you.